The following program is dedicated to the honor of the men and women who have served and of those who are currently serving with the Armed Forces of the United States Military.
Live from the Veterans Radio Studio on the Ave Maria Network in Ann Arbor, Michigan, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host for today's program, former CB, Gary Lilly.
Hey, good morning from Veterans Radio, Gary Lilly. July 1966, Vietnam, Republic of. And sitting with me right now is former 101st Airborne, former Big Red One, Bobby Gould.
Oh, thank you very much, Gary. Looking forward to the program today. I read the flyer. It's going to be very exciting.
It will be. It'll be Sarge Heck, wired together, going strong, successful. Now, this guy's got he's a head-shaking, amazing person. Boy, when you hear what he has done and where he came from, astounding. Sitting over in the control booth, we've got Matt. Good morning, Matt, running the control board.
Good morning, everybody.
And we have Ty over there just taking care of our photographs. Not just, that's important.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Ty. And good morning to everybody out there around the world and around the
around the globe. Oh, yeah. We already said that.
Yeah, that kind of covers it.
Yeah,
doesn't
that covers it, right.
Now, here's the thing. I've been saying to the folks down there in Antarctica, we want to hear from you, somebody in the military base. Maybe our program doesn't reach them. I doubt it. But I'm going to do the opposite now. I'm going to bring Antarctic to the listeners because I got a program coming up in a couple of weeks with a couple of CVs that were down there in the Antarctic. You know, they're the ones that keep the airfield running and keep the water plants running and all that. And one of them, on the last day that they closed up the water plant on the glacier next to the airstrip, they went swimming.
Yeah, I got to see that.
Antarctica.
I got to see that.
Bobby, what do you have for us today?
Okay, folks, today we've got three items. We're going to be talking about milestones in the history of veterans. Dateline, Detroit, Michigan. Veterans get final honors. U.S. Army veterans Anthony Bullock and William Rowland Jr. shared many similarities in life and death. The men lived in Detroit, they served their country in the armed service, and they died alone of heart disease. Their bodies remained at the Wayne County Morgue for more than a year because no next of kin could be located. Rowland, 78, was a private who served from 1947 to 1950. Bullock, also a private, was a radio operator in Vietnam and an expert rifleman. He also received the Combat Service Ribbon and a Vietnam Service Medal. Little is known about these two, yet on Monday, about 90 people, including Michigan Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, showed up to honor these men at the Great Lakes National Cemetery. Bullock and Rowland were the first veterans in Michigan to be given free military burials through the Dignity Memorial Homeless Veterans Burial Program. The men were given a joint funeral service with full military honors. The service included the playing of taps and the ceremonial flowing and folding the flags draped over the men's caskets. Quote, "We believe that all Americans who serve their country deserve honor and respect in life and certainly dignity in death," said Vern Pixley, president of Pixley Funeral Homes. Gary, you had something to add on that?
I do. I saw that on television. It was, you know, pretty big news because they were finally able to release the names of the people, Privacy Act, you know. And so that started the program where they can bury these guys. The funeral home did it pro bono. And what was really heartwarming to me was to see the men of Rolling Thunder and Patriot Honor Guard show up to honor them as they were being buried. You know, these are mostly Vietnam and Vietnam-era people, but there's others besides, and God bless them.
No, these are our fellow brothers, and they're not alone now because we took care of that.
That's right.
One other quote I'd like to say, they're entitled to the honors that they were given them. That said, from the Great Lakes National Cemetery Director, Rick Anderson. Dateline, Minnesota. Jane Russell, actress, died this past week. Born in Minnesota, Miss Russell appeared in over 40 films, beginning with The Outlaw. During her life, she consistently remained part of the veteran experience, touring with Bob Hope and the USO for many years and visiting vets at the VA and local fundraisers. There we go. Many World War II GIs kept her pinup photo.
There it is. And then there's another one after this. Go ahead.
To remind them of what they are fighting for. And that's the famous one of her on the hay bale.
There you go.
There we
right
are.
On time, Ty.
They kept that in their helmets. They kept that close to their hearts. It was one of the things that kept our soldiers thinking about home. That along with Betty Grable.
She was, both of them, beautiful, beautiful ladies. But
beautiful.
Wow.
Beautiful women.
Beautiful.
And I didn't
how
know
beautiful.
And, until we did this little piece how much Jane Russell was involved with the veterans.
That's right. Some of these great stars that would travel with Hope, travel to see the vets, really raising the spirits.
And,
oh, my.
And that is their time. That was on their time. And
that's
they
right.
took time away from their families on the holidays. She was married in the beginning for 30 years, I believe, to Bob Wakefield, quarterback for the L.A. Rams.
I knew I'd recognize that name. Yeah.
And she was signed to a 7-year contract in 1941 by the guy who had the spruce goose, Howard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's his name? That guy.
Dustin Howard. No, that
right,
wasn't
right.
him. Howard Hughes.
Howard Hughes.
Yeah, there we go.
Right. Leave it up to the young guys.
They had more coffee than we did this morning. So here again, here's to you, Miss Russell. She was 89. The third on our triumphant today. The last U.S. veteran of World War I died at 110.
Ty, that wasn't Jane Russell. There he is.
He didn't seek the spotlight, but when Frank Buckles outlived every other American who served in World War I, it was because he was what his biographer called the humble patriot and final torchbearer for the memory of that fading conflict. Buckles enlisted in World War II at 16 after lying about his age. He was only 15.
World War One,
15.
Yeah, 15.
Yes, they actually didn't give you the eye test. They just counted them. They had to get a lot of guys, you know.
Tell the story about how he kept getting rejected and how he finally made it.
Well, he went to a number of recruiting offices, and he was just too small for the Marines, and somehow they just said, you're just too young, kid, but the Army took him. He was 15.
He kept telling them he was 18, and they kept laughing at him for that. He told the next one he was 21.
Yeah, and that must have made it. How can we make sure that World War I isn't forgotten? We're always asking ourselves, how can we represent the story to the world? Born in Missouri in 1901 and raised in Oklahoma, Buckles entered the war to end all wars. He repeatedly was rejected and became an Army captain.
I've got something to add on to that. Are you finished with that one?
No, not yet.
Keep going.
Oh, okay. Mr. Buckles' burning desire to get into this horrific conflict was typical of the strong patriotism and even innocence of his generation. He was the last of 2 million Americans, 2 million Americans who went to Europe to make the world safe for democracy. More than 4.7 million people joined the U.S. military in 1917 and 1918. So half went out there for the war to end all wars.
Right. And last man, 110 years old.
Last American.
Yeah.
Well, and the other two there, they're in France and England. There's some doubt. There's some doubt whether they're actually authentic or not.
Well, he was the photograph up there. He was a good looking guy, right?
Oh, yeah.
He was an old man. I was driving back from getting out of the military after Vietnam with a buddy of mine from Pop Benji. We called him. His name was Pete Roy. we stopped at a bar in Illinois, of course, you know, got a little thirst, and it was an old-time bar, and you knew it was old-time, it was an old storefront, on the door that had a sign, no women, and, you know, that was how some of the places were back then in the 60s. Went inside, and, slate pool table, stand-up bar with a brass rail and all that, and a bunch of old-timers sitting at a table, and they were all veterans, and the tables were the ones with the press-back chairs and everything. And they were teasing the bartender about his war, and it wasn't like their war. These guys had to charge up a hill to beat the Spanish. They were all Spanish-American vets.
Oh, okay.
And the youngster that they were giving a hard time was a World War I vet.
Oh, yeah.
It was so great.
Good story. The family asked that any donations, be made to the National World War I Legacy Project. In 1941, he was out of the service, but he was also as part of doing service work, military work, for the U.S. government. Frank Buckles was 110. Radio will be right back after this important message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Back on Veterans Radio, some of the music from when we were growing up, the Age of Innocence. You're not on the air yet, Bob.
Okay. Yeah, but not only the Age of Innocence, but that great music. How could you be sitting down and hearing that? You got to get up and dance.
You'd have had to have seen it. Even you people on the webcast couldn't see it. Bob's over in the control room dancing, showing his moves. Well, this morning we've got a program, like I said, titled Sarge Hack, Wired Together, Going Strong, Successful. This man was seriously wounded in Vietnam, but he had a pretty interesting life up to the point where he made it over there and has gone on to become an incredibly successful businessman. And I would like to this morning welcome Sarge Dave Hack. Good morning, Sarge. I told you guys, don't let me push buttons.
Good morning, Sarge.
Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you.
Okay. We got a picture of you. Pretty good looking guy, man. Where were you born?
I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, April 21st, 1940.
When you went to school there, you already had family that had been in the military.
My oldest brother and second to the oldest brother had served in Korea during the Korean War in the United States Marine Corps.
What did they do?
They were in aviation. My oldest brother was a pilot. and still is. And my second oldest brother was in office work in the 1st Air Wing with the United States Marine Corps.
Okay. One of them is since deceased?
The third oldest brother is deceased. His name was Lloyd Hack.
Was he in the military also?
No, he wasn't. He died at a very young age. He died at 54 years of age. And
I'm sorry to hear that. I thought one of the ones that serving in Korea had died.
No, sir.
Okay. Well,
no, sir.
Before you served in Vietnam, before you served in the Army, you served in the Coast Guard. Tell us about that. And why did you join the Coast Guard?
I had entered the Coast Guard immediately after high school in 1957 and thought that the Coast Guard was extremely challenging, and I still feel that way today, and served 4 years in the Coast Guard. Two of the 4 years I stayed seasick, was on ships. I had thought that the Coast Guard was, you know, protecting the coast, but I was misled a little bit there. The Coast Guard travels all over the world in big ships.
Yeah, Bill Thornton.
And it was a rude awakening.
One of the hosts on producers on Veterans Radio's father was in the Coast Guard in World War II. He served on an LST that was eventually hit by a kamikaze off of Okinawa. So they do range a little ways away from our coast.
They most certainly do.
When I was in the military, we used to joke about the Coast Guard saying you had to be 6 feet tall to place your boats on so you could wade ashore.
And I've heard that joke before, too.
I'm going to tell you something. I have since learned about the Coast Guard, and they're brave. I mean, my gosh, they go out when everybody else is in trouble.
That is a certified fact. They really do.
So God bless the Coast Guard. You guys are incredible, incredible, and brave. Sarge, how did you, what happened when you got out of the Coast Guard?
When I left the Coast Guard, I still liked the military. I most certainly enjoyed the time in the service, with the exception of spending a lot of time on the fantail getting seasick. Fantail meaning the back of the ship.
Right.
And I went into private business, and that wasn't too successful for me.
What kind of business?
I owned a nightclub in Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay.
And ran that for, close to 4 years, about three years plus.
What years would those be?
1961 to 1964.
Okay, then I was never in it.
Yes, sir. And then I was in Phoenix, Arizona, and I was walking by this recruiting station, and the door was open, and this Army sergeant was sitting there, and he says, "Where are you going?" And I says, "I don't know." He says, "What are you doing?" And I says, "I don't know." And he says, "Come here, man. I want to talk to you."
He had a live one.
I'm serious. And so I went in, sat down, and he says, "How would you like to join the Army?" And I says, "You know, I really hadn't thought about it, but I did enjoy the military." And he says, "Look," he says, "How would you like to join the Army Rangers?" And I says, "You know, I've heard about those guys, and they don't go to sea, do they?" And he says, "No, they don't." And I says, "Well, you know, sign me up." So I enlisted at that time and went to Fort Ord, California.
Now,
and
tell me, how old were you at that time?
I was 24.
Okay. Well, you'd done a lot before you turned 24.
You betcha.
How old were you when you enlisted in the Coast Guard?
I was 17.
Okay. You were legal.
Yes, I was. And with my parents' permission. And so I went from Fort Ord to Fort Benning, Georgia, to the 1st Ranger Battalion. And there they says, "Ha-ha, you were in the Coast Guard." And I says, "Yeah." And they says, "The Coast Guard runs small boats, don't they?" And I says, "Yes." And he says, we're going to send you to Eglin Air Force Base at the Army Ranger Camp. I says, great. And I says, what about my Ranger training? And he says, don't worry about it. We'll train you there. And I says, oh, okay. That sounds like a winner. And so I went to Eglin Air Force Base, to the jungle school, and I was there for 2 years. And running small boats and doing the training from the Army Rangers and going into the back rivers and then coming in from the Gulf of Mexico for the LCU and LCBP and the landing crafts and the rubber rafts, but I never went to school, and I kept asking my first sergeant. I said, "When are you guys going to send me to school?" And he says, "Well, you're OJT." And I says, OJT, yeah, on-the-job training. I says, gotcha. I says, but I know that I need to go to school. And he says, don't worry about it. It's needs of the Army. Right now, we don't have time to send you to school. You're too busy. So I wrote a letter to the President of the United States at that time, Lyndon Baines Johnson, President Johnson. And I wrote a letter and I said, you know, I've been down here 2 years. These guys are working my butt off, you know. 24/7, and I need to go to school. And they says, well, forget it, you know. And I wrote this President of the United States, and I says, you know, I want to go to school. And the letter came back through the channels, and the first sergeant called me in, and he says, Hack, no one writes to the President of the United States in my command. He says, pack your bags, you're going to Newfoundland.
From Florida. You got results, only not the ones you were looking for.
I says, get out of here. No way, Jose. So off I went to Newfoundland. I was up there for 6 months. And from Newfoundland, I went to, I was going to Vietnam, and my stepfather had passed away. And they reassigned me in Louisville, Kentucky at the AFES, Armed Forces Examining Station, on a compassionate reassignment for a year. And then I went to Vietnam in 1968 during Tet.
During Tet, and you ended up at Live Cave right off the bat?
I went to Cameron Bay first. We flew into Cameron Bay, and when we landed in Cameron Bay, I said, wow, man, this is like Hawaii, you know? Everybody's running around with bathing suits and shower shoes, and you know, there was no, you know, action whatsoever. And I thought, if this is Vietnam, this is great. And then the next day, they told all those guys to stand out, stand in formation. And we were all lined up, and they called our names out, and they called my name out, and they says, you're going to the 1st Infantry Division. And I says, oh, boy.
Big red one.
Big red one. And from there, I went to Zeon, the headquarters, and then from headquarters, after processing, I went to Lycay. And Lycay is the Michelin rubber plantation. And,
oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. It was a Michelin rubber plantation. And it was a very hot zone. It was right in the Iron Triangle, and it was the headquarters for the 1st Infantry Division.
Ty,
yes, sir.
Keep a couple of those photographs of Lycay up there. You just showed the village itself, and now you've got a place called the Plaza.
Yes, sir.
I mean, this is like the shops of, what is it, of America, the big, right? It's like a, sort of like a United States shopping plaza.
Well, not exactly. It was a little primitive over there. But, you know, I put that site up on our webpage at uswings.com. I did that several years ago to help people. And we have received such a tremendous positive response from that, because a lot of guys, for one reason or another, the pictures that they had, if they had any, were destroyed.
Right.
So I put those pictures up, like I said, so guys could look at that and say, oh, yeah, I can relate to that, no matter if they were at Lycay or any other part of Vietnam.
A village looked like a village up there.
A village is a village over there. in Vietnam was extremely primitive, and it has been a healing process for so many guys. And parents too. Right.
We're going to compress your service in Vietnam. We want to show a couple of pictures of some hooches that were yours and a couple of 122 millimeter rocket near misses, and then one where you got a hit on your bunker. Tell us what your job was and about those rockets.
Yeah, when I first went to Lycay, well, not exactly. When I first went to Zeon in processing, of course, they saw that I was with the 1st Ranger Battalion, and they sent me to Lycay as a combat career counselor, and my job was going around throughout the whole division, flying in, flying out, and different base camps, counseling guys as far as what jobs that they were doing, what job they wanted to do, if they wanted to stay in the armed forces, re-enlisting them, if they wanted to go to school after they rotated back from Vietnam back to stateside, because things just didn't stop there. And I was the counselor for the division headquarters as far as career counseling goes. And the CG, Major General Keith Ware, had heard about me. And he was a two-star general and a real neat guy, just a nice person. And he had heard about me and asked me to come down to his office at IK and be interviewed for a position. And I did. And the job was NCLICA protocol. I would take care of all of the protocol activities that occurred with the 1st Infantry Division. And in doing so, actually my job was being his aide and also being his bodyguard. And that was my job with the CG. I was his bodyguard for maybe about 3.5 months.
How was it that you were wounded? You were wounded quite hard.
I was wounded twice. The first time I was wounded by a 122 millimeter rocket. That was at Lycay, and that was April the 10th, 1968. And then the second time I was wounded was Friday the 13th, September, 1968. And I was on top of a armored personnel carrier, and the word for that particular vehicle is a track. And we received a direct hit from an RPG round. And
what's the range of an RPG?
You know, it's not a great deal. I would say that, 100 yards is really stretching it.
Really stretching it, yeah. So this is up close and personal.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like a 122 rocket.
No.
Not in the general vicinity. This is a guy.
No.
He had something personally against you. Did you
remember
what it was?
I don't know. I always joked around. I said, someone said shut up, and I thought they said stand up. But a lot of those guys fired those things from spider holes. They would dig a foxhole, just enough room for them to stand in.
We got a half a minute left in this first segment, believe it or not. You were wounded. You were badly wounded. Do you remember anything during the time of your wounds?
No. I was wounded in my leg, my face, my back, my shoulder, and my chest. And I spent a year in the hospital, and then I stayed on medical hold for five years.
Were you unconscious?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We're coming up on a break. You're listening to Sarge Hack, who is who was wounded in Vietnam and came back and made a very successful life.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
First Lieutenant Jack Jacobs, although seriously wounded, made repeated trips across an open rice paddy, evacuating wounded and their weapons. Details after this.
It's not easy being a veteran.
Coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, I had been so excited to come home.
But it's harder than I thought.
Not everyone understands that.
Join us at communityofveterans.org.
Because no one knows what it's like to come back unless they were there.
Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Jacob served as an assistant battalion advisor in Kien Phong Province, Republic of Vietnam. The battalion was advancing when it came under intense heavy machine gun and mortar fire. Jacobs called for and directed airstrikes on the enemy positions. Due to the intensity of the enemy fire and heavy casualties to the command group, including the company commander, the attack stopped and the friendly troops became disorganized. Wounded by mortar fragments, Jacobs assumed command of the company, ordered a withdrawal from the exposed position, and established a defensive perimeter. Despite heavy bleeding from head wounds that impaired his vision, Jacobs returned under intense fire to evacuate a seriously wounded advisor to safety, where he administered life-saving first aid. He then returned through heavy automatic weapons fire to evacuate the wounded company commander. Jacobs made repeated trips across the fire-swept open rice paddies, evacuating wounded and their weapons. On three separate occasions, Jacobs drove off Viet Cong squads who were searching for Allied wounded and weapons, single-handedly killing three and wounding several others. His actions saved the lives of a U.S. advisor and 13 Allied soldiers.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we're back on Veterans Radio talking to Sarge Hack. Wounded.
Yes, sir.
And, I'm sorry?
I said yes, sir.
Yep. I want to just finish up a couple of minutes on. Did you ever know who the medic was that treated you?
No, I don't. I did meet a medic in Vietnam that, I still remember his name. His name was Vaughn. And I had gotten stung by a scorpion. And I went over to the tent, and I told him what had happened, and that my leg was starting to swell up. And he says, Sergeant Hack, let's play some tonk. And I says, play tonk? And he says, yeah. And so we put this 5-gallon gas can between us as a table, and we were sitting there playing. And I says, okay, Vaughn, what's going on? And he says, it's like this, Sarge. He says, sometimes a guy gets bit by a scorpion dies, and sometimes a guy gets bit by a scorpion just gets real sick. He says, I just wanted to make sure that you're not going to die on me.
How old was he?
Vaughn, I guess he was probably about 20, 21 years old.
Right.
Lost it when he said that.
Well, this is what I was driving at.
Oh, okay.
Some medic who was 19, 20, 21 years old worked feverishly over you to save your life. And you don't know who he is.
No.
And I interviewed medics and corpsmen. Sometimes they were 19, 20, 21-year-old guys.
Oh,
they did things that trauma surgeons don't do. And they did them out in the field, saving guys' lives by stuffing cigarette filters in them and, putting cigarette wrappers over sucking chest wounds and that. And, they get they get very emotional at times.
Oh, yeah.
And I said to a real close friend of mine,
uh-huh.
He was going through hard times, and I said, Doc, there are young men and women all around this country who would like to know who you are so they could thank you for saving their daddy's life.
Absolutely.
Yep. And so you are a prime example of it. You have children, do you?
I do.
Wouldn't they love to be able to see that medic and thank him?
no doubt in my military mind. No question about it. The thing about it is, I woke up and I think it was Long Ben, because they medevaced me out. And I woke up there, and then from there they transported me to Japan. I was at the 106 hospital in Japan. And then after Japan, they stabilized me, and I was there for a couple weeks or so. And, you know, I woke up in Japan, and I heard these guys talking in Japanese, and it was a TV, and I opened up my eyes, and it was Lloyd Bridges, and he was talking in Japanese. They were translating the TV show, you know, right. You know, Sea Hunt.
I remember that when I was on Okinawa, R&R.
I know. It freaked me out. And then from there, they medevaced me to, they sent me to Fort Bragg. And now here's something that really, really drove home. I'm going to Fort Bragg. My home is Louisville, Kentucky. Fort Knox is right outside of Louisville, Kentucky. And I'm at Andrews Air Force Base, and they're refueling the hospital plane. And this colonel, he comes aboard the plane, and he says, any of you guys have any questions, concerns, or problems? And it's a hospital plane, and I raised my hand. And the colonel came back to me, and he says, what's your problem? And I says, well, I'm going to Fort Bragg. I'm going to be a long-term patient, no question in my mind, because I was pretty well tore up. And I says, you know, Fort Knox is right outside of Louisville, Kentucky, and that's my home. You know, this colonel called the Pentagon and took me off the plane.
Really?
He did.
And put me
on a plane and sent me to Fort Knox, Kentucky. And as they're doing this, he reaches down, he shakes my hand, and he says, welcome home. And I tell you what, that to me stuck in my mind, and it will always be there for the rest of my life. He says, welcome home.
You know, first time I heard that was about 30 years later when I finally joined Vietnam Veterans of America.
Mm-hmm.
At my first meeting, and I think I know who it was, but I'm not sure. Guy said to me, welcome home, and he put a bear hug on me.
Yeah.
We happened to be standing next to a table, and I put my left hand on that table, and it was that and his bear hug that kept me from falling. I got so dizzy at hearing those words, and so emotional. I had
extremely emotional. Extremely emotional.
Oh, what?
And what a meaning, because it's all sincere. It comes straight from the heart.
Right.
You know, what a feeling, you know? And, you know, I always remember that. I always carried that forward. And it was sincere. And this was in 1968. This is 2011. I still remember what the colonel looked like, still remember his words, still remember everything. Everything. And then as I'm a patient there in Fort Knox at Arleigh Army Hospital, all those guys, you know, that became a healing process for us.
Right.
Because, you know, we joked around and we compared war stories and it helped us.
Yep.
It honestly helped us to go forward. And then these guys came around to my bed, and they came from the Department of the Army. And they said, Sergeant Hack, how would you like to be an Army recruiter? And I looked at him, I said, you guys are crazy. You know, I said, me a recruiter? There is no way, Jose. And I said, get out of here. And this one colonel, he says, no. He says, we want you to become an Army recruiter. And from there on out is all history, because I did become an Army recruiter.
We want to see a picture of your Jeep up there. If you would put that up, please. Matt, your recruiting Jeep is enshrined in the museum
at Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
And that's only one of two Jeeps in there, is it?
There's no, there's one. General Patton's Jeep is at Fort Knox, and my Jeep is at the Pratt Museum. And what had happened, the 101st Airborne Division came to me, and they said, you know, heck, we would like for you to recruit for the 101st Airborne Division because we need men in Vietnam. Bad. And I was the number one recruiter out of 6,000 Army recruiters throughout the nation. And I said, okay, I'll do the deal. And I'll put the extra effort in for you. And I says, but how about giving me a Jeep? And this captain says,
you're a negotiator right from the start.
Yeah, I did. This captain says, he says, you know, if we do this deal, it's got to be between us. So the captain brought the Jeep up from Fort Campbell, Kentucky. I met him in Columbus, Ohio. They signed the Jeep over to me, signed over the books, everything. I took the Jeep, took it to Akron, and then I painted it. Red, white, and blue, put mag wheels on it, wide tires, airborne on the front, airborne on the back, a white top, did the whole nine yards, really decked it out. And I used that Jeep for 3 years. And Newsweek had done a story about me. And the commanding general heard about it. And he called the command sergeant major in. And he says, Sergeant Major, I would like to have a Jeep done up just like that. And the command sergeant major looked at the CG and he says, General, I got to tell you something. He says, what's that? He says, that's our Jeep. And the CG says, what? He says, that's our Jeep? And he says, yes, that is our Jeep. So he says, I want that Jeep down here now. So the CG called the USAREC CG, U.S. Army Recruiting Command CG, and says, what the blazes you guys doing with my Jeep? That's my Jeep. So anyway, to make the story short, the 101st Airborne Division CG took the Jeep back to Fort Campbell. They used it on tours for the 101st, and then afterwards they enshrined it into the Pratt Museum.
That's incredible. We're running out of time on this segment, too. Mm-hmm. You had something to do with Muhammad Ali when you were recruiting?
I gave him the test. I gave Cassius Clay the Armed Forces test when I was at AFES in Louisville, Kentucky on a compassion reassignment. Yes, sir.
We got a photograph up there now of you passing the word on to Top Sergeant. What was the word you were passing on?
That there was no way that he would ever have been drafted because he flunked the test.
And there's one of those stories behind the story.
Yes, sir.
There's another photograph of you swearing in a kid that volunteered to go to Vietnam.
Yes.
Now, I've got a personal reason for asking this. You ever think about these people that you recruited and what might have become of them?
After an awful, awful lot of research of every person that I enlisted into the armed forces, 99.9 went into the Army and received trades. I lost only one applicant, and his name was Lewis. And he was killed in his sleep by a mortar round.
We're talking to Dave Hack, Wired Together, going strong, successful, and when we get back, we're going to talk about his business and then a remarkable thing that he is doing on his own. We'll be right back.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you.
The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University by combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Everybody always picking on me.
Oh, Charlie Brown, he was always getting in trouble. You remember that song, Sarge?
I most certainly do.
Mostly we play songs from the air, and I thought, wait a minute, let's play some songs about when we were growing up. And they were light, other than the ones, oh, Dinah, I love you, you broke my heart, and all those types of things. It was a very innocent time. The reason why I asked, why I said I had a personal reason for asking about, did you ever wonder, as Vietnam vets, we are invited in to talk to the high schools.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the teachers tell us that even after kids graduate, they ask if they can come back when the Vietnam veterans visit the class. I think we do a real good job. But then one day in the town of Chelsea, Michigan, we got word that a young boy had been killed over in Iraq, and it haunted me. Did we do anything that caused him to enlist? You know, it's a good thing if we did, but it's something that weighs on me. And you said you actually researched all the people that you recruited.
Yes, I did.
Astounding, astounding. And I guess you had, and you know how the one died, that killed by a mortar.
Yes, I did. And like I said, the young man's name was Lewis, and I remember him very, very well, and I researched it, and he was killed in his sleep. He was with the 9th Infantry Division, and he was in personnel, and a mortar round came through the roof and killed him in his sleep. He was a good person, and the other men that enlisted with him all came back home and to Akron, Ohio. The neat thing about being a recruiter at that time in my life is that, you know, I gave it 110%, and I was extremely proud to serve my country. I was extremely proud of the men that I enlisted and women. And like I said, there was over 6,000 Army recruiters. And I was the nation's number one recruiter for 4 straight years. And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and to me, I felt that by giving my all for my country and helping other men, that was the bottom line. Just plain and simple. It isn't. People misunderstand their true meaning. It really isn't what you do for yourself. It's what you do for others. That's what counts. You know, it's what you do for others. And that's the way I've led my life, my 70 years. And by golly, that's the way it's going to be all the way up until the time that I punch out. It's what I can do for others.
And we're going to have a good example of that. We're going to be talking about it in a minute. And we're only going to be able to spend about a minute on U.S. Wings. Tell us about your business.
Our business is uswings.com, and we were the first company to go on the Internet. I'm a government contractor. I also sell to the civilians. We're a bomber jacket manufacturer. We also sell Hawaiian shirts, but we do all kind of neat stuff. And we help an awful lot of people. We help a lot of Vietnam vets, and we reach out and do anything and everything that we can for our fellow man.
And how many hits do you get on your website?
Over a million a month.
A million a month.
Over a million a month.
How many? How do you accomplish that?
Well, by being on the internet for, you know, since 1986, 1994 when we first really formed our website, by owning over 200 URLs and all of those 200 URLs pointing to uswings.com, and by being so well known and so well respected, a lot of people know about us.
It's astounding. That's how I discovered you. I don't remember exactly what I was looking for, but I went to ended up at uswings.com and I saw the story on it, and I said, I got to talk to this guy. Called you from my mobile phone and sitting in my car in a parking lot, and that's where we talked. And
well, I'm glad you did. If you look on our website, you'll see a picture of myself and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. And if you look on our website, you'll see me with a picture of General Wagner, which is the Lieutenant General in charge of Special Forces and the United States Army Rangers. You know, that kind of association most certainly does not hurt U.S. Wings.
No.
It most certainly doesn't.
How many of your jackets do you sell?
Well, tens of thousands, because we supply all the armed forces.
Okay.
We supply the Coast Guard, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Air Force. We also reach out and supply the New Zealand Air Force and the Australian Air Force. And we do about 99% of all the aviation movies, plus Civil Air Patrol, and the list just goes on.
And I see that we're showing one hand-painted Flying Tigers on the back of it. You've got somebody that actually hand-paints them for you.
Yes, sir. Our Flying Tigers jacket was worn by Dick Ross. He just passed away. Dick was the president of Flying Tigers, and he and Chenault formed the Flying Tigers, and that jacket is in the museum over in China, in the Flying Tigers Museum.
Really? Really? That's all right. Now tell us what you're doing for the vets with all your success. Something coming up.
We have a rally coming up the 21st of May. And it's the 50th anniversary rally, and
of which?
This is of Vietnam. I'm sorry,
of the beginning of the Vietnam War.
Beginning of Vietnam, 1961, and we're kicking it off here in Hudson, Ohio. If you go to our website and look under U.S. Wings, and then go to the Vietnam rally, it tells all about it, and we're extremely excited about it. And like I said, it's a kickoff for it. And it's something that is totally free, and it's open to the whole entire world.
Now, there's two big reunions that take place for Vietnam vets, one in Kokomo, Indiana, and one in Melbourne, Florida. There might be some over on the West Coast, but I've never heard of them, if there are. They are, you pay to get in at, or you pay for camping at least at Kokomo, and it's 20 acres, and it is filled up with campsites. You've got 27 acres, and you're opening it up.
Yes, sir, free.
And vendors.
Vendors is free.
Food.
Free.
Non-alcoholic beverages.
Pass on that. We do not drink here. We do not smoke here.
No, I said non-alcoholic beverages.
Right.
pass on. Well, you're supplying beverages?
We are.
Yep, free.
Free.
I asked you, how long can somebody stay camped there? Because a lot of people will come in and set up camps. It looks like the Crusades with all the flags flying.
They can stay here a week.
1 week. So get there early, camp out, be with your brothers and your sisters.
You betcha.
And what a time. What a time. It's easy to find your place.
It's extremely easy because we're right on the Ohio Turnpike. There's a map there. We're right between Akron, Ohio, and Cleveland. You can come in from Michigan straight on the Turnpike. You can come in from New York straight on the Turnpike. Or you can fly in at the Cleveland Hopkins Airport, or you can fly in at the Akron Canton. And we even have a private airport here over at Kent State. that will accommodate jets.
And so it's going to be easy for anybody to get to. You are well positioned, and I have never heard of anybody doing this and flipping the whole bill.
We are definitely flipping the whole entire bill.
All right, we got about 30 seconds left for you. Is there anything that you wanted to say that we didn't cover, Sarge?
I'd like to say something to all the veterans, no matter what branch of service, no matter what conflict or war, welcome home.
And those, I just got a chill just hearing that, those words again. That's so powerful to veterans and Vietnam veterans. I said it to a Vietnam veteran the other day, and he heard it for the first time, and his head snapped back just like mine did the first time I heard it. And he looked like he was getting a little bit of a tear in his eyes. Fortunately, he was sitting down. Sarge Hack, thank you so much for being on Veterans Radio, and welcome home to you, too.
Thank you, and God bless America.
Absolutely. Well, next week we're going to be having another one of these good programs on Veterans Radio. Bob's working on one, and I'm working on one, so I can't say which one it's going to be, but it'll be somebody that's just the regular person who's served their country well, and it's the personal stories. And I've always said, if you walk through a VA hospital, you're going to see more stories than Hollywood could ever use in its existence. So until next week, from Veterans Radio to all of you, welcome home, and you are dismissed.
Not all views and opinions expressed on Veterans Radio reflect the views of Veterans Radio or your local station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.
Business and individual income tax planning and preparation, QuickBooks training, and payroll services are just some of the professional accounting services available from me, Len Pitlack, CPA. With 30 years of accounting experience and a Washtenaw County business owner myself, I know the business importance of having a sound accounting advisor. Call me at 800-377-7879 and get the answers you need.